Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On this week's show, we finally admit that working from home has got too much for us and we need a bit more space. So Team Filibuster is upping sticks and moving to a bigger place in Fear Street Shadyside. Apparently there was an incident recently and real estate is an absolute steal at the moment. Of course, what I really mean is that we're going to be reviewing Netflix Fear Street Trilogy 1994, 1978 and 1666. I'm your co-host, Dallas King, and back on the show, it's practically magic to have her. She certainly knows her craft. She's our very own Witch of the Woods, or should I say Vivivitch of the Woods, Kim Morrison. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when this sort of episode sort of came up, it's a perfect reason to get you back on the show. I always love to talk about horror, unlike Lee, who has not joined us on this episode. Clearly the pressure of watching three horror films almost back to back, well, certainly on a week to week basis, must have been too much. I think the needle drops probably did him into submission during this one. But I'm sure we're going to hold our own talking about this trilogy. And another reason that I wanted to have you on is basically you're a much more of an expert on R.L. Stine than I am anyway. When I was growing up, I think it was the point horror books that I read growing up. I didn't really read much R.L. Stine. I knew of him from Goosebumps, but not the Fear Street trilogy. But am I right in thinking that you've spent a lot of lockdown essentially? Was it you who said that eBay was essentially a place to go to spend a lot of money buying back everything that your parents had gotten rid of when you moved out of the house?
Yeah, that was me. It was right at the beginning of lockdown last year, actually. I bought the original run of Goosebumps, not it, because there's
first editions all the way, of course.
There's been many, many different versions, but the ones that I had when I was a kid, I can't really blame my mum, because I know there was periods in my life where she did say to me, would you want this anymore? And there must have been a time in my life where I never thought I was going to reread Goosebumps, and I was like, oh, it's fine, get rid of them. But to be fair, I didn't have all of them. I maybe had 10. We used to have like a library van that came around my little village, and I was an avid library user for Goosebumps books. So, but yes, I now own every single, the first, I think it's like 64 or something, Goosebumps books. And I do plan on making my way through them all, because they're very big font and they're only about a couple hundred pages each. So I think I could read one in like an hour or something if I just went for it. But I was a massive Goosebumps fan as a kid, the TV show and the books. I kind of missed, I was aware of Fear Street and Point Horror, but I can't pinpoint which ones I actually read, again, because it was all at the library, so I didn't have Goodreads as a child. I have lost the knowledge of which books I read in primary school, unfortunately.
What did you make of the Goosebumps movie, incidentally, when it came out a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I only watched them recently with my daughter, because she... she's into the Goosebumps TV. The TV show terrifies her. Like, she likes watching it on Netflix, and then she just insists that I don't even have the like thumbnail up on the screen for the next few weeks, and then she wants to watch it again. But the film's actually quite, like, the second one's not too good, but I really like the first one. I thought it was like, it's one of those, like, a good introduction, I think, to kids for all the different kinds of monsters and things that exist without them being like too scary. I think the TV show is more like the books, where it's quite actually scary, whereas I think the film was a bit more like Scooby-Doo-ish. So I think it was a good introduction to give kids a basic knowledge of the world of horror without turning them off it for life.
Absolutely, yeah. Unlike Fear Street Trilogy, which I didn't actually realise until about the third one, that actually certainly here in the UK, they seem to be rated 18, which, having watched them, I thought was slightly harsh, I think. I guess we'll get to that as we dive in. So what feels like for the first time since the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the entire Fear Street movie trilogy was shot back to back, and in a move that would have hugely benefited the Star Wars sequels. So certainly all three were directed by one person, a female director in Leigh Janik. And in Fear Street 1994, a circle of teenage friends accidentally encounter the ancient evil responsible for a series of brutal murders that have plagued their town for over 300 years, the myth of Witch Sarah Fear. So, essentially, I guess since you've now admitted that you haven't really read the Fear Street novels, and neither have I, I'm not sure how close to the storyline that they take. I believe that the Fear Street series of novels all took place in the town of Shadyside, but the movie seems to have given it a slightly wider context, almost one which I would refer to as Parks and Recreation-esque, with Sunnyvale, not Sunnydale, which I think was the Buffy town, Sunnyvale and Shadyside, which essentially, the town used to be called the Union and then was split into two almost warring factions where there's a rich side and a poor side, and all the murders, indeed I think it's called the murder capital of the US in Shadyside. So essentially it is Eagleton versus Pawnee, and we spend a lot of time in the Pawnee of the horror world in this. So we're introduced to a series of kids who are living in Shadyside, and then one night after a big football game, there's an incident where they come into contact with the legend of the witch, and all hell breaks loose, essentially. If I'm going to, you know, reduce it down to very, very basic terms, I guess this first one would be dubbed the Scream of the trilogy, I guess, in that it starts off with a big name kill, well, one of the bigger names on the list, in Maya Hawk, getting offed by a masked killer in a Stranger Things-esque shopping mall. I mean, what did you make of this first one? I mean, were you looking forward to these when it was announced that they were dropping actually in quite quick succession? I believe they were originally being produced at Fox, but then when it got bought over by Disney, I think it was Netflix stepped in and decided to take them. And whereas in traditional years, I guess you might have had a film come out every Halloween, perhaps, they've decided to go for the more rapid fire drop for the week, 3 weeks. So what did you make of the news that this was dropping quite quickly, actually?
Yeah, no, I thought it was good. I'm a very impatient person anyway, and I think also because of like lockdown, I feel like we've been waiting, like Halloween Kills, I feel like I've been waiting about 18 years to see Halloween Kills, and I wasn't even that like keen on the first one. Like I was like, yeah, it's good, but now I'm like, oh my god. So I think if they said they were going to do one a year, I would have been like, nah, I cannot deal with it. I think the fact that it's such a interconnected story between the three, it kind of feels more like just one big story rather than like a film and two sequels, basically. I think releasing them very close together was a smart decision, and yeah, I think the amount of the amount of horror especially that's been delayed because of lockdown, I feel like we deserved this. Yeah, the horror community needed this to just come out in a winter and it'd be like this big exciting event. And I think as well, a lot of the times, like stuff that Netflix releases, like their own, the kind of original stuff or whatever, it's not always great. It always gets hyped up and you see loads of BuzzFeed articles about, oh, this is the scariest film ever and I couldn't sleep after I watched it, and none of them are that amazing. So the fact that this was like a big thing, it was Fear Street and it was R.L. Stein, so even if you didn't know about the actual Fear Street books, you at least knew it was a cool thing. The fact that it was getting released on Netflix, and like most people have Netflix and we could just watch it in our house, I think was really exciting. So I was super excited for this coming out.
Yeah, I think it certainly benefited from them filming all three back-to-back. I think whereas the It Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 were good, I think, unfortunately, the delay in filming Part 1 and Part 2 meant that some of the children aged more rapidly than the other ones, and then they had to employ some dodgy sort of CGI to keep them looking the same at certain points. So I did like that there was this huge sort of interconnected world, and I guess we'll get onto in the third part, certainly the casting choices in that, the way they went with it was quite interesting as well. I guess it's fair to say, I mean, it's probably not the most original of stories. It's fairly standard. There's a curse, people are chased, people die. I did see one of the criticisms of the first part was maybe not enough people died. There did seem to be a big chunk of time in the middle of it where people were looking for people to get off in gruesome ways, and maybe that didn't happen, but I mean, what did you make of the pacing? And, well, I guess the cold open, as they would call it, on Saturday Night Live with the with Maya Hawke.
I loved the opening. It was so good. Like, I was very sad when I realised that they were pulling a Drew Barrymore and Maya Hawke was going to die, though, because, like, I love her in Stranger Things. I was very excited to see more of her, and I was just like, I was so annoyed when I realised what was happening. But I loved it, because obviously, I mean, it's very obviously like a Scream homage. I'm not like having a breakthrough by saying that, but just I think the amount of effort they put into making it a very good Scream homage, even things like the way the killer's like costume moved, and the kind of like sound effect that came in when he like swiped her and missed and things, like, it was, and even the music over the opening credits was very like the kind of Scream theme music as well. It was just so perfect.
Well, I think it was Marco Beltrami had done the score for the. He was one of two people on the score of the Fear Street movies, and he did the. I think he was that was the first sort of films which I knew of him as a composer was the Scream ones and the Faculty as well, I think. So it was nice to get that sort of callback, I guess.
Yeah, it just had a perfect like 90s kind of feel about it, and without it seeming like a rip-off, it just seemed like a perfect kind of homage. And I mean obviously the rest of the film isn't particularly like Scream, so they weren't like ripping it off the whole way through, but it was nice to kind of get that feel kind of settled in the world of like 90s horror with that opening. I felt like you kind of knew what you were getting a little bit with it, but no, it was brilliant, the opening.
Yeah, and then after that we're introduced to our main set of characters. Where apparently I didn't really sort of realize it until the end, but basically there's, apart from the sheriff and stuff, there doesn't really seem to be any adults around in the set. All the kids are just left to their own devices. You know, they're off. The adults are clearly working night shift or something, and basically told, you know, kids are told, you know, make yourself dinner, I'll be home late and stuff, but you know, never see them again. So it's interesting. And then you've got the main girl who is. What I really appreciated about this film as well was the fact that the LGBT sort of story at the centre of it was treated essentially, you know, with no big deal. You know, obviously there's one of the other girls' parents are frowning upon this. There's like the jealous new boyfriend who's aware of what's been going on and stuff like that. But I did like the fact that it was basically treated as this is the central romance of the story and, you know, deal with it. I thought that was really nice to see. I mean, what did you make of our central set of characters? I mean, you've got the main lead, you've got the love interest, the geeky brother who's on his interesting. I'd forgotten how basic internet forum chat rooms were back in, because I had to keep remembering it was 94 and whatever, so that's why, you know, you've just got these basic text chat platforms and stuff. And it was like a, I mean, what did you make of the central characters? Were they easy to sort of root for, or, well, I mean, there was certainly one jock who were like, yeah, I really hope you get stabbed quite quickly.
Yeah, the main group of friends I thought were great, and they were really interested, and I don't think they played too much into like the kind of typical slasher stereotypes, I guess, but I think that made it difficult later on. I think they made you care about the central group too much, and then they decided to start killing some of them, which was really just like, oh, okay. I think they needed to be more kind of like fodder in the middle of people to die, like they said. But I mean, obviously it makes sense when you find out the whole story of why the killers are chasing specific people. It does make sense as to why everyone wasn't getting like killed left, right and center. But I thought they worked really well as a group, and they were clearly very strong friends. The killers were, once they kind of figured out they were only really after Sam, they still pretty much stuck together the whole time, which I think was good, because in a lot of horror films people can just turn out to be kind of horrible, and they had kind of moments of, I think, just general like human fear for their own lives.
One discussion in the school where it was like, oh, they're only after her, all right, just lock her out in the corridor and we'll be fine. And then they're like, oh, actually, I feel bad about that, we should bring her back in.
Exactly. Which I think is like quite realistic. I'm sure everyone would probably have had that thought, but the ability to follow through on it, I think, was what decided that they weren't completely horrible people. But no, I thought they were great as a friend group. But yeah, I kind of wish there'd been more people on the sidelines that if there was going to be like bloodbathy deaths later on, it maybe could have been some other people that we didn't like as much.
Yeah, I think, yeah, because there's a lot of sort of collateral damage in terms of hospital orderlies and police officers and things like that, but people you didn't really get to know, I think, because it was such a small group. I think it's about really essentially sort of five at the heart of this, because none of them are essentially in any real danger until the end. It's like, well, there's who else is going to get killed off? If it had been a wider group of, say, maybe 8 to 10, you probably would have sacrificed a few in the middle. Which,
yeah.
But I guess it means then that it hits a little bit harder when they do sort of enter the final act and a couple do get off. And, you know, I did see some people complaining about the fact that there wasn't a huge amount of deaths, but I think it's fair to say that the two of the deaths at the end were quite extreme, to the point that I was very surprised that Netflix actually put a clip of one up online on Instagram and stuff like that, and it's like, you know, basically sort of saying, you know, Fear Street is the greatest thing since sliced bread or something like that, and it's like, wow, okay, that's a choice, because that one was certainly something. I mean, what did you make of the violence, as it certainly seemed to turn up a notch towards the end?
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of went into it expecting it to be quite violent because, as you said, they were 18, but all the stories I read were like, oh, R-rated, so it's going to be an R-rated trilogy and stuff. And I was like, right, so it's going to be really like violent and stuff. So, yeah, the fact that there wasn't, all the kind of bits leading up to that weren't overly violent for a slasher film, they really saved it up for those last couple of deaths. And it was that way where, like, I was like, oh, that's a good death, but I didn't want that character to die. Like, it was such a horrible mix of emotions that I'm still not really sure how I felt about them. They were very shocking and very well done, great effects, but I read someone online said that they wished like one of the deaths had been like the person had kind of turned it around and put the killer through it instead, because they appreciated the effect but they didn't like the result. And I was like, yeah, I kind of feel the same. Like, it was, they were very good. And yeah, if they had that potential to come up with these amazing death scenes, I kind of do wish there'd been more, because they were very inventive and cool. But yeah, no, they were amazing. But yeah, I kind of wish there'd been a bit more in the middle. All the ones in the middle were just a bit kind of people getting stabbed, and it was quite, which is quite normal for a slasher film, nothing too really ordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say, I think the second installment, which we'll get onto in a minute, certainly ups the body count on and off screen, so get into that. But I think the big thing I want to talk about just before we move on to the second one is the needle drops, which is a phrase which I don't think really has been used in terms of relating to films, except for like suddenly in like the past 3 months, everyone keeps talking about needle drops in films. I think it was rather like Cruella, where essentially for me, if someone says, someone talks about a needle drop in a film, it's basically a very on the nose use of a song to, you know, express what is going on in the film. And this film certainly does have a lot of them. Certainly, you know, as they're introducing all the different characters going through school, you've got like a bit of Portishead, you know, nobody loves me, and then you've got all this sort of thing to, you know, shorthand for characters' emotions and stuff like that. But I believe someone ranked all of them for the first movie, and there's about 20 different films that get 20 different songs that get dropped. I mean, did it get a bit much for you in the beginning, or...?
Yeah, it got... I did appreciate it, because I do always love a good sort of, I was gonna say retro there, and then that made me feel really old, because like obviously the 90s isn't retro. I was thinking about the 70s one as well there, but I do love a good like 90s soundtrack as well. But I think at the beginning it felt like a lot, because they were only using like 10-15 seconds of a song, and then it was going straight into another one. So I do feel like, yeah, they were good, and it was a good soundtrack. But I do feel like, especially that first chunk where they went into the high school and they were going to the football game and stuff, there was maybe a bit too many, or they maybe just could have spaced them out a bit more. But I did Hey by the Pixies is like my favorite Pixie song ever. We were watching it with subtitles on, so the lyrics for the song came up before it even started, and I went, "Oh my god!" And then my boyfriend was like, "What?" And then it like kicked in, and I was like, "Yes, this is just like..." So I'm not gonna deduct the points for using the Pixies, because that's just one, it's amazing. Two, that song especially. So you know, I think it was good, but I think they got it a bit better in the '70s one. They spaced them out a bit more, but there were still loads that felt you were very like embraced in the era, but I think they maybe crammed a little bit too many in at the start of the '90s. But I guess there's just so much good like '90s slightly alternative rock to choose from that they maybe found it hard to narrow it down.
Yeah, I'm just probably being overly picky. I think if I went back and watched something like She's All That or 10 Things I Hate About You, I would actually realise that they basically needle drop like every 10 to 15 minutes or something like that. So it was probably actually very accurate for a 90s teenage set film to have that many songs in it. But the film sort of ends on a cliffhanger. I sort of rewatched the final sort of moments just before this podcast, and I do kind of think that it's a bit odd actually that for the entire essentially second film that the lead character, I'm pretty sure, was stabbed in the stomach, but it kind of just walks it off, really. It's like, oh, it's no big deal. So at the end of the film, they think the curse has been lifted because they read about a girl who in the 70s murders was basically killed, but then was basically... her heart stopped and was brought back to life. So they think if they can stop Sam's heart, they'll be able to lift the curse, which they do. But then it turns out, oh, surprise, surprise, it's not over. And we get teased straight away, as in the coming soon, next week, actually. We get the grown-up version of one of the characters from the second film, who is about to tell us a story. And that story is taking place in Fear Street Part 2, 1978, which is... basically then looking at school is out for summer and the activities at Camp Nightwing are about to begin, but when another shady sider is possessed with the urge to kill, the fun in the sun becomes a gruesome fight for survival. Part two essentially becomes our Friday the 13th homage, where lots of camp counsellors and young people are killed in a summer camp. And I think we were just talking about needle drops there. It's essentially saying that basically if you want to have a film set in the 70s, you basically just take the Dazed and Confused soundtrack and then just overlay it over the top, because there are, I mean, I'm sure there must have been more songs in the 70s that were used, but when you have School's Out, Cherry Bomb, Slow Ride, I don't know, just Dazed and Confused was one of those films which I watched sort of growing up as a teenager, so therefore I guess, you know, I'm sure other people have other points of reference for these particular songs, but those are my, that's my reference point. So anytime I hear those songs, it immediately takes me back to Dazed and Confused. So that's just me. I mean, I don't know that you do have a different reference point for these songs, or is it Dazed and Confused as well?
No, I've not seen Dazed and Confused, so is it? It's probably just general, like, 70s horror, like Halloween and stuff. And they didn't let me down by including Don't Fear the Reaper, which I... actually wrote an article about once, because the amount of horror films that in is actually ridiculous, but it's obviously, it's quite prominent in the original Halloween, so I was very glad that they got included in this one as well. No, I'm trying to think, I mean, I knew all the songs that they were playing. I'm not really sure where my reference for them was, apart from, yeah, just probably general like 70s horror films, but I have been singing Carry On My Wayward Son for about 2 weeks straight now because of that film, so that's fun.
I think
fun.
Of Anchorman, I think, with that one now.
Yeah.
But I'm sure when you watch Dazed and Confused, if you ever get around to it, you'll be like, huh, this is just Fear Street 1978. Yeah. So this one, basically, you know, the small sort of setup for anyone who had forgotten what happened in the film that they probably just watched 2 minutes before watching this one. So then we get sent back into the thing where we've got Sadie Sink from the Stranger Things is playing the younger version of the Christine Berman character, and she is, you know, there's a few other characters. There's the character of the sheriff, Nick Good, is in this one, and I think it's safe to say it explains why he has a slight limp in the first film, which is nice to see that kind of sort of callbacks and stuff like that. They've clearly thought a lot about it. And there's one particular needle drop, which I thought was actually very good in this, in the fact that they start off the film with the Nirvana version of The Man Who Sold the World by David Bowie, which was played at the Unplugged gig that they did on MTV, which I think everyone in the world had the album of in 1994. And then they play the original at the end, and I'll come on to the end, and I'll talk about why I was so impressed with that particular needle drop. But one thing I want to talk to you about this is it sort of does up the body count, expands the mythos behind, you know, there's a bit more exploration into the legend of Seraphir and sort of discovering, you know, where the body is, you know, why the hand is missing and stuff like this. And basically, it sort of expands onto the mythos about why every sort of few decades, another person is basically seems to be possessed by the witch, goes mad and kills a bunch of people. And one of the big things which people were talking about in this is in the original Friday the 13th movies, the character of Jason's mother in the first one, not Jason, it's always Jason's mother. You know, everyone seems to forget that, but we don't. Jason's mother and then Jason are killing the counselors because they were off basically taking drugs, drinking and having unmarital sex when they should have been looking after the kids. And that's when Jason died the first time. So it's obvious that, you know, fair game on them. But what people were surprised at was the level of that basically all bets are off. Anyone on the camp is basically a target for the killer. But what I was really disappointed with, and I don't know what this says about me, is that all the children who were killed were kind of killed off screen. And it's like, it's an 18. If you're consciously making the decision to at least give us one where you see like the fat chubby kid with glasses get axed in the face or something. I mean, were you upset that we didn't see that on screen, or were you impressed that they still decided to murder anyone who was on Camp Nightwing at the time?
I mean, yeah, it's a bit of both, really. I was, because I mean, a lot of horror films where it's teenagers, they're usually played by like 30-year-olds. So the fact that they were actually played by actual like young teenagers, the fact that they decided to kill the characters off at all, I thought was quite impressive. Because things like Friday the 13th, it's usually like, oh, we're setting up the camp for the summer and it's just us horny camp counselors. There's no actual children involved. So the fact that they decided to kill them, I thought was quite impressive. But it was a bit, even like the stoner girl camp counselor, she kind of got killed a bit. Like kind of off, there was just for being an 18 and they're making a huge deal about this rating and things, I think they could have done, I mean, obviously there were some really good just like full axe to the face kind of kills, I'm not denying
it,
but
decapitation, actually, yeah.
But yeah, I feel like there probably could have been a few more on screen kills, just to make it a bit different and a bit more violent. But I guess there's probably only so many ways you can kill people with an axe. It probably would get boring just watching it all, so they probably just tried to mix it up a bit. But I do appreciate that they had the balls to just kill a bunch of the kids as well, rather than them kind of all escaping. So that was impressive.
Yeah, it did kind of veer wildly from it's kind of shown off screen to the ending where the two sisters are, it was like the scene from The Simpsons where it's like, stop, she's already dead. It's just like almost like a full minute of just continually just being stabbed in the stomach or something. It's like, how is she? I mean, obviously, yeah, you see that, you know, oh, she's dead, but then she comes back to life, and it's like, I'm not sure you'd be able to survive what looked like about 30 stab wounds to the stomach, you know, because let's face it, the ambulance is probably quite far out of town, you know, at this point. So I was, you know, satisfied. He did wildly go from completely off screen to, wow, I'm actually now kind of slightly like creeped out by how long it's sort of lingering on this one particular death scene. It was like, ouch. And so, you know, fairly standard, you know, how did you feel about this new set of characters being introduced? Obviously some are younger versions of the characters that we meet kind of at the end of the first one. I mean, what did you make of them? They did seem to fit more into the sort of stereotypical sort of roles of, particularly I guess because it was trying to fit in with that sort of early 80s late 70s slasher mode, I guess.
Yeah. No, I really liked this group. I thought the two sisters were great. I was very sad that you immediately knew one of them was going to die the minute the film started. So that was quite traumatic. But I thought they were both great in different ways. This is the only film where I will say I slightly liked Nick Good. He ruined it at the end, but for a chunk in the middle, he actually seemed quite nice. And I
You would
thought,
have joined a Stephen King book club with him, would you?
yeah, exactly. Yeah, him and Ziggy seemed like nice friends and stuff, and it was cool. And I thought, oh, I can't remember her name, the girl with the short blonde hair, the other camp counselor. I thought she was really nice as well. Again, it was a bit of a, I think you got a bit too attached to them for coming up to the end. It was a bit like the first one, because even though they did do a good job of killing off sort of other people in between, but I thought no, it was interesting kind of following the sisters two like kind of separate stories and like seeing them interlock and stuff. But I thought they were really nice. And I think, yeah, a lot of the times with these kind of camp slasher films, there's you don't always like a lot of the people involved. A lot of the camp counselors are usually quite nasty and things, whereas I think all the camp counselors were nice. They were just maybe liked yeah, sneaking off to do stuff they shouldn't have been doing, but they were all nice people underneath it. So yeah.
Although it did seem very sort of stuck on dividing the groups into your shady side is where Son of Elas were just better than you sort of thing. So, but I mean they were good. I mean I was hoping for maybe slightly more from the maybe sort of bait and switch of because you know basically the film opens with this is us at Camp Nightwing and a week later my sister was dead. It's like okay maybe there might have been a bit more of knowing that she's going to die at some point, there might have been more sort of fake outs, or maybe, oh, is this when she's going to die, or that. And so I thought there might have been a bit more than that. And I mean, what did you make of the central killer with the sort of traditional sort of burlap sack?
Yeah, that's like my, I was gonna say my favorite, but probably my worst type of serial killer is a sack faced cat, especially with an axe. It just brings back memories of The Strangers, which I think the ending did as well, with a just unnecessarily long scene of people just getting stabbed to death. It was all very Strangers-y. No, I loved it. I mean, he wasn't the most threatening looking guy before he got the mask, but yeah, when he had the mask on and stuff, it was just great. He was really creepy. I think they did a really good job overall in all the sort of different killers that they had in the film. But I liked his like kind of half run with an axe at people, and just like the blank face of his mask was really, yeah, really creepy. So no, I did like him. I thought he was a good, I mean, obviously probably mostly Jason-y, but like a bit. The burning and stuff as well, I guess. Just that kind of blank-faced camp killer, just taking out people, as many people as possible. So yeah, I thought he was really creepy. Yeah, I didn't think the skull face killer in the first one was particularly creepy, but I really liked him as the kind of central one. I can understand why everyone was absolutely running for their lives from him, especially in the dark in the woods. It would have been terrifying.
Yeah, and I guess also sort of Strangers-esque was the sort of I guess in the first one and the third one the Ruby Lane with the singing of an old timey song again and again and again. Although I did want more from the sort of the baby killer with the mask on the sort of little kid with his little sort of baseball bat or something like that. I was hoping for a bit more from him in the third one because they sort of teased him up but never. He never really got his due, but I guess there's potential in the future. So at the end of sort of part two, you know, sort of we come back to, you know, basically Ziggy is brought back to life, but she's off to hospital, and Nick Good is revealed to sort of basically be part of this sort of cover up and sort of she, you know, she tells him the curse is real and stuff, and he's like to the cops like, oh, just. Some guy went mad and whatever, and you're like, oh, maybe that's because he's worried that people wouldn't believe her. But of course, it turns out there's an alternative reason to why he's doing that. And at the end of the film, you know, part two, we've got the hand and the body being reunited, and then sort of Dina sort of then transported back to 1666, into essentially the body of Sarah Fear, where we learn that the third film is going to be setting up the truth about the curse and how she became the witch. And in that one, we basically get the casts of the first two movies are playing versions of these characters in 1666, which is sort of filmed in a sort of very sort of almost sort of washed out sepia tone, which basically this is their Robert Eggers, the witch version of their trilogy here. And they also go with the decision to basically have the Union, as the town was back then, was a basically a town of Irish settlers. I think it'd be fair to say that most of them were attempting an Irish accent. Is that correct?
Yeah, I hope so.
So yeah, it was certainly a choice. I mean, what did you make of the decision to have the cast from the first two films in the third film as in the 1666 roles?
I thought it was really clever because it was just nice to see like everyone again. Obviously, if you're some people, you're only going to get to see them for one film, so it was nice to kind of see everyone again. And it sort of it showed you the amount of like parallels, I guess, there were between what the town was like then and what the town was like in 1984, and also just like Sarah Fear and her group of friends, the similarities that her and Dina have like in the future. Even things that I didn't think about, like someone pointed out the fact that Kate was still a drug dealer in 1666. She was the one dishing out all the
fruit
that was going to get everyone high and stuff like that. So I think it was really, yeah, I think it was smart. It was nice to see them all again, and they set up a lot of kind of, I think, clever stuff between all three films of just how it kind of implied, I guess, that like stuff was passed down generations and things. The Irish accents were a bit questionable. I don't know why, I was saying like, I know they were maybe going for like obviously accuracy and stuff, but I think like the fact that because Dina was in Sarah Fear's body, you weren't sure like how accurate the whole thing was. Like, did all these people actually look like that, or was that just how Dina was seeing them because she was having the vision? So I think if they'd all just kept their original accents, it wouldn't have seemed out of place. It would have just been like, oh, this is her like having a vision of it. So I think some people were fine at the Irish accents, and other people it was kind of dipped in and out a little bit, but it wasn't the worst. I think yeah, anytime people attempt Irish or Scottish accents, it can sometimes come off terrible. It definitely wasn't the worst I've heard, but I don't think they needed to put the actors through that.
And so this film essentially reveals the origins of the curse, where, you know, there's a lady who lives out in the woods who deals, she's got books with incantations and all that, and it sort of delves into the sort of, I guess, the hysteria around the Salem witch trials and stuff like that, where basically anyone, and when I say anyone, essentially women, were treated for being different, and especially because it sort of harks back to this relationship between Dean and Sam, where they were lovers and somebody sees them together, and then something, you know, this whole Wicker Man thing where, oh no, the crops are failing, or the town water supply has gone bad, so therefore it must be witchcraft, and it must be those two over there, because, you know, clearly men are not responsible for tending the crops and stuff like that, so it obviously couldn't be their fault, you know, I'm just saying. And then it sort of delves into that, and then we get the situation where, because she's been accused of being a witch, she decides that, well, if I'm being accused of being a witch, I'm going to become a witch, and she goes off to get the book and make a deal with the devil. And then this is where, I guess, you know, we can sort of press pause and say, from now on, we're going to reveal spoilers for the series. So if you haven't seen it, I mean, you can right now. You can just pause, go watch them on Netflix and come back. Okay, we all good? Good. So when she goes back, it's revealed that the book has already been stolen and the witch has been slain. And it's that someone else in the town is responsible for the misfortune which has taken over the town, which basically was the first of these killings in which the pastor basically locked a bunch of kids in his church and gouged out their eyes in a very sort of Event Horizon sort of thing, which I think that's the first film I go to whenever there's an eye gouging and sort of do you see sort of moment. I mean, what did you make of that in particular? Because that was probably the most unsettling moment in the film.
Yeah, I think it was quite surprising because a lot of the characters that were playing the kids were people that we'd seen in other films and had survived, like seeing them get their eyes gouged out. It was like, oh, wow. Obviously, we kind of knew it was coming a little bit because the eyeless pastor was one of the ones that they talked about in the original film when they were kind of going back through all the killers, but we hadn't seen him up until now. It was quite a shot. I do wonder how he managed to survive the initial eye gouging, because the killers didn't seem to have the supernaturalness until they like died and then they were able to come back, but he was just fine with the eyes, but all the kids had died with the eyes, and there was just a big pile of eyes on the floor in the middle. It was my go-to eye removal film is the remake of Black Christmas, the middly one. So it was quite similar to that, just a big heap of eyes in the middle of the thing. At least we didn't have to watch them all getting gouged out, which I think would have made it worse. But again, them just deciding to murder a bunch of kids. So I guess you can kind of understand, I mean, the town's hysteria, like the start of the stuff with the fruit being bad and the dog in the well and stuff, like that's all very like standard kind of witch trial, let's blame this on other people's stuff. But like, god, if the town pastor suddenly went nuts and took all the children's eyes out, you probably would be trying to find like a explanation for it, I guess. So you can kind of understand it a little bit, why they were so desperate to kind of find out what had happened.
Yeah, and what turns out what had happened is that when she goes to her best friend in the village, it turns out it was the best friend in Solomon Good, an ancestor of Nick Good, who had taken the book and basically made a deal with the devil where he would sacrifice the soul of one member of the town in exchange for basically prosperity and lots of nice things. And he chose the pastor, which is why the pastor gouged out his eyes and then killed all the kids. So that's the price to pay. And then I guess following this, he basically then frames Sarah Fear as being responsible for it, and she accepts her fate in order to save the life of her lover, but in doing so curses Solomon in that she will always be with him and she will always look to expose the truth. And then that sort of falls back to the very beginning in 1994, where the killers are only targeting people who have touched the corpse of Sarah Fear, and they are basically essentially controlled by the Good family in order to keep their dark secret a secret. So it puts a nice spin on sort of everything that you've seen already. I mean, what did you make of this reveal? Were you expecting it, or were you expecting Sarah Fear to have gone mad and made a deal with the devil herself?
Yeah, I'm not I don't really know. Like, I didn't expect it to be anything to do with the goods, and I saw a lot of people on Twitter being like, if you didn't see that twist coming, and I was like, no, shut up, come on, just let people enjoy things. But no, I'm not sure what I think. I maybe just thought, yeah, it was her, like Dina, getting the insight into kind of what had happened with Sarah and kind of seeing, I thought there might have been like something more behind it, like the reason why she made the deal with the devil, but the kind of the setup of her going to do it to try and save Hannah and everything made total sense. So I kind of was like, all right, yeah, this seems fine. But I loved the reveal so much. I thought it was amazing, especially it kind of, I can't remember if it's here or when it flashes back to the future, but it kind of shows like all the generations of the Good men like picking their killer, and it shows young Nick Good picking Tommy to be the killer at the camp, which I don't understand, because like why would you do that at the camp that you're at? Just putting yourself in, like, I mean, obviously wasn't gonna get killed by him, but just like the fear of being involved in the situation and everything. But no, I thought the reveal
nearly
was...
went badly for him, because he ended up getting like an axe to the back of the legs.
Yeah, I wonder if there was like a limit for how much the killer could hurt him. Like, I'm not gonna kill you, but we've got to make it look realistic, so we've got to like axe you up a little bit. But no, I I loved it. It just, it was, I thought it was really good. And then I think it was like the double knife twist when he framed her for it, when she like kind of came out, and before she even had the chance to try and blame on him or anything, he just like went right in there. And the fact that they were like such good friends, and it was just such a horrible situation. Like, it just made it, I guess the first two films, you just spent the entire time thinking that Sarah Fear was like this horrible, vengeful witch that was just like killing loads of people for no reason. And then you just discovered that not only was that true, but she's got like so badly set up for it by like, yeah, someone she considered her best friend. It was really horrible. And yeah, he'd bloody crunched her hand off as well. Like, he's just such a horrible person.
Yeah, so much for saying that. Yeah, it was basically, I mean, it's that thing, it's how you present the story and whatever, and, you know, with all the fairy tales and the rhymes and whatever, and basically it was like, well, she chopped off her own hand and gave it to the devil in exchange for, you know, witchy powers. It's like, okay, fair enough, that's accepted. And then it's like, turns out, no, it wasn't. It was like, she was trying to get away in order to do that. She basically had a knife in her hand and basically ended up getting ripped off. It was like, ouch, that is very, very sore. But it sort of harks back to the end of the second one, where I talked about the man who sold the world, the David Bowie song, where essentially that plays over Nick Good and his sort of, when he's talking to the police about the fact that it wasn't anything to do with the curse, it was just, you know, one kid had gone mad and whatever, and essentially the Goods were men who sold out their own town, so the people in their own town, they sold the world down the river in exchange for, you know, prosperity and stuff like that. So he sold out Shady Siders throughout many, many generations in order to further himself and his family. So I thought it was a really nice, that was a very good needle drop that takes on a different meaning when you finally see it all put together. And I think I did admire, you know, it wasn't, you know, there were moments where throughout the trilogy where it was like very sort of standard and formulaic, but I think overall, I think, and this is where it helps having the same writer and the same director over the whole thing, and, you know, I think she did a fantastic job of not only having this story which worked. I mean, I couldn't really think of any real plot holes looking back at the whole overarching story and how it all fitted together, but also being able to juggle effectively the tones of being able to do a 90s slasher, a 70s slasher, and then a 1666 Salem witch trial movie, and it all feeling like one sort of cohesive story, I thought was very impressive. I mean, what did you make of the direction of the trilogy?
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. I think going through, there was stuff that I thought was like plot holes, but obviously it was like, just wait until they're all finished and then you'll discover that they're not. Because things like when we were talking about like, how did Ziggy survive all those stab wounds? Apparently Nick says something to her at the end, when they're back in the 90s. He kind of says something that implies that he he does CPR on her, but it kind of implies that because he has like magic on his side, that that's maybe kind of what brought her back to life, rather than, yeah, because I don't think CPR would work for like 94 stab wounds to the chest. It's kind of implied in that. So there was loads of bits like that where, I was a bit worried that there was bits that didn't make sense, but when you actually watch the whole story, everything made sense. I think the continuity was great, and the little kind of callbacks between the different films and the different characters was amazing. And I think it was impressive that they managed to have three very different kind of types of subgenre of horror films, like kind of newer slasher and then camp slasher and then kind of folk horror stuff, and it all just felt very, yeah, it felt like that was kind of like their speciality. It all felt really good. So I think they did an impressive job of not having, like, I don't know, not kind of sticking to the one style and kind of branching out over different types of horror, and all of them felt as good as each other, basically. I think they did, it was impressive that they managed that.
Yeah, no, I thought she did a fantastic job, and I'm really interested to see what she does next. Obviously, you know, these days you can't just leave it at that, and there's got to be a hint for more in the series. You know, obviously you don't want to do a dark universe and basically, you know, set out your stall before you've even started the universe. I did notice quite, I don't know, it could be quite prophetic for the Dune franchise, which essentially they've said is basically the new Dune film out in September, October is part one of two, but it's just been called Dune. It's not because of Dune part one. They basically filmed the first part and they need to film the second part, and they've already started with the tagline "It Begins." And it's like, I've seen how his Blade Runner 2049 did at the box office, and I have a feeling that, you know, this is not Star Wars, and it's quite a big ask to not have completed filming the whole Dune film series before, you know, the first one comes out. And so, yeah, I don't know how that's going to work, but I guess, you know, Netflix are also very good at, you know, starting off a show or a film series and then cancelling it before it really gets anywhere. So I guess we'll have to see, you know, if the numbers of this over the past month have done enough to justify more stories in the Fear Street saga. Obviously, you know, the book is mysteriously unaccounted for at the end. You know, you just leave a huge piece of evidence like that lying down in a cave for someone to come along and steal. Obviously, you know, there was, it sounded like the Good family were saying that Nick was responsible for the whole thing and it was nothing else to do with us. So perhaps the brother who was sort of mentioned, actually it looks like quite a few times just in the background as mayor of the town or something like that. So assuming that he might become the big bad in the second series. I did go and pause the film at the end. So it is a pair of man's hands that pick up the book. So it is a male character. I was wanting to see who had picked it up. So were you interested to see, you know, what happens next in the Fear Street genre? Obviously, I can't remember how many books there were in the series, but there clearly must be plenty of stories or killers from the past to potentially do a spin-off of.
Yeah, I think the fact that they managed to create so many different like stories coming off from the main story and things that they definitely feels like the series has the potential to be interesting. It's one of those things where I do want to see more of it. I'm kind of, I don't know how I feel about someone stealing the book at the end, because then I always worry that you always want, when the characters have been through a big like, traumatic time and like all their pals have died and stuff, you kind of want them just to be left alone in a story and be like focused on somewhere different. So it kind of worries me that if someone nicked the book that like Dina and her pals might get dragged back into it as well.
Are you referring to poor old Sidney Prescott? Yeah, from the Scream series, who was, oh, it's like, have we got anyone else? No, we just got to bring her back in. Someone else from her past who was related in some tenuous way to the original killer is coming back to finish the job. And stuff
yeah,
like
you just think people wouldn't survive that amount of like trauma in their life. They just wouldn't be able to deal with it. It's no, just
they either go completely mad or become Laurie Stroud, who becomes a survivalist expert.
Exactly. But no, I kind of, yeah, it's kind of, you think it, even Dina would have lifted the bloody book knowing how easy it was to just summon the devil, just say like 12 different names for the devil and then that was it. You think someone would have lifted it, but no, I am interested to see. I've seen a lot of people saying how they want to see more about like the killers that we didn't get to see much of, like the mailman with the face and the other guy who looked like he was wearing like a pig anteater mask thing. I don't know what he was. I can't even remember because obviously they mentioned a lot of the first film and then by the time you see them, you kind of forgotten their backstory. But it would be cool to see a bit more of them. So even like a series that focused on the killers, like their kind of killing spree and stuff, I think would be interesting. But yeah, I would love to see more of it. I think they did a very good job.
Do you think it would work as a, like a limited series, maybe like a half hour, 40 minute episode or something, rather than like a feature film? Do you think there's life potentially in a series of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think especially if they were going to try and focus on smaller stories rather than the big ones, especially if they were going to do like the killers or whatever, because obviously we know the bigger overarching story of it all, we would need to keep going into that every time, but it would be cool to kind of delve into it. It feels like Shady Sides had so much stuff happen to it over like all the like 300 years or whatever, like it would be, there's so much potential for stuff that I feel like it would definitely be interesting to kind of dive into it a bit more.
Yeah, it seems like it's probably not the type of town that is probably purely limited to everything's circled around that one particular family and the witch. I think there's probably other mysterious goings on and stuff like that that could be explored. So I guess we'll have to see in time. But that brings us to the end of Fear Street. I'm very excited to get you back in August to talk about Censor by Prana Bailey Bond. I've been harping on about it since January, so I can only apologise if you, when you finally do see it, if it doesn't live up to the hype of me going on about it for about 8 months. And then also, listeners, I was going to say viewers, not viewing, you're listening. Listeners, let us know if you would like us to put Lee through the ultimate torture, which would be watching every single Halloween film to do a special episode in the run-up to Halloween Kills. There's a lot of them now. We would have to decide if that includes like the Rob Zombie sort of remakes and stuff like that. Is that maybe not?
Okay. That's I've seen the first one twice and the second one once, and I feel like that's enough.
Okay, so maybe just the ones which exist in the Laurie Strode universe.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you would like us to do a Halloween special in October in the run-up to Halloween Kills, let us know. Let us know on the comments on social media or drop us a message. It'd be interesting. I've mooted the idea, and I know Lee's already sweating in dread because, you know, three Fear Street movies was a tough ask for him. So we'll have to see, because I think he's only probably watched, is it the first one? And then also H2O. He did an episode with you on that one.
Yeah, I was going to say that was my fault as well. I to watch H2O.
But yeah, to watch all 8 or 9 of them or whatever it is. But yeah, you get some Paul Rudd in the middle there. So, I mean, that'd be something. So I guess we'll see. But thanks for joining us this episode, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.